Hello, everybody. My name is Hector Elias, and I'm an alcoholic. Hi. Do I look green? It doesn't matter. When you're a sex symbol like me, it doesn't matter. I was saying to a friend of mine, you know, now that I don't dye my hair anymore and I shave my mustache, I look like a new Ricardo Montalban. Listen, Alba, I think I'm a sex symbol. She says to me, Hector, you're not a sex symbol. You're a sex symbol, Hector. See, when you're tall, young, and good-looking like me, people hate your guts. I was saying to a friend of mine, he was talking about Buster Keaton. I said, Jimmy, that was before my time. He says, Hector, the only thing before your time is paradise. I like to hear people laugh. If God says, you know, he wants us to be happy, joyous, and free, laughter is the voice of God. And we're trudging the road of happy destiny. We're not trudging the road of disgusting misery. And that's what I like to hear, laughter. Before I get on with my pitch, I want to thank the people who put on this beautiful, beautiful convention. Let's give them, all of them, a huge applause. Yeah, yeah. Woo! Shaking it, bring it down, feeling good. Yay! I mean, this is a phenomenal job. These people have been working for months on this. You know, I just finished being like a secretary in my speaker meeting. You know, it was only 6 months. By the end of it, I was ready to kill a few alcoholics in my group, you know. And I also want to thank the people, the co-chair and co-chair of the speaker committee, you know, Rick and Mike. They were so kind and so loving and so gentle. And this fantastic fruit basket they put in my room, you know, it's just beyond description. You know, I don't think I had to eat now for like 3 days, you know, so much food in it. I also want to thank, I think it was Bob, that he invited us, you know, over for Thanksgiving to his house. It was such a powerful meeting. I go to a lot of meetings in L.A., but it was such a powerful meeting. There was such a feeling of gratitude, of love. It was just, I said, you know, we don't have to go to the convention. After the meeting, we had it. You know what I mean? It was phenomenal. I want to tell you that whatever I say from the podium is just my experience and my opinion. Unfortunately, I happen to be very opinionated. And I may be wrong, but I'm never in doubt, okay? One of the wonderful things about Alcoholics Anonymous is we can disagree about many things. As long as we don't drink or use and work the steps, you know, we'll stay sober and change. And change is the most difficult thing we do in Alcoholics Anonymous. If I frown a little bit and I look down, it's because these lights are very bright, you know. It doesn't matter. I'll suffer, you know. Anyway, I'm going to start at the very beginning. My father is an Arab, my mother is an Italian, and I was born in Argentina. I'm glad you think it's funny. I think I came out Japanese. They were poor, they were illiterate, they were violent, they dressed badly, and they smelled even worse. You know, we were poor, poor like in Argentina, you know, poor in this beautiful country of ours, you know, is like middle class all around the world. We didn't have, you know, like, we had dirt floors, no running water, and not a bathroom, an outhouse, no heat, you know. And so we were real, real poor, and I was very ashamed of my home, and I would never invite any of the kids home because, you know, I didn't like them to see the way we lived. And they were very violent, my parents. But I didn't know I was an abused child until I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. See, here they give you all these problems. You see, I thought all kids got chained to the sewing machine. You know, oh, it was not, my mother chained me to a sewing machine. It was nothing personal. You know, she also chained my little sister and the dog. You know. And I'm going to tell you a little bit about my parents, not because they have anything to do with my sobriety, but later on, and I tell you how I dealt with that, you know, in sobriety. No, I did not go to ACA. I just worked the steps on them, and they were really very violent. You know, being at home was like being in a minefield. You know, Mom, if I would do something wrong, she said, "I'm not going to chase after you. He had to come to sleep. And when I was sound asleep, at 1 o'clock in the morning, she would uncover me and beat my ass with a shoe. And I wake up being beaten up, you know, like a little kid, and I don't know what's going on. So for the first 18 years of my life, I slept totally covered because I didn't know what was coming. My father was more violent, but he did it less often, thank God. I want to tell you also, neither one of them drank. You know, and nobody in my family drank. I'm the only alcoholic in the family. So I really did not like my parents. My first dream as a child was not to be president of Argentina, a movie star, or a doctor. My first dream as a child was to kill my daddy. What are you going to do, Hector, when you grow up? I'm going to kill my daddy. With a dull razor blade. And I grew up, you see, I didn't grow up to be a very secure young man with a lot of self-esteem. But, you know, when I think back in hindsight, I saved myself. When I was 12 years old, I got into sports and I began going to this gym. I come home, I drop the books and go to this gym, you know, and this nice gym. And there were kids from middle-class neighborhoods, you know, and they had nice homes with bathrooms. And they had like faucets and toilets in the bathroom. And they slept in pajamas. And they had matching bedspreads. And I learned what life was all about in the homes of these kids. And when I was 18 years old, I left home and I moved away from home. And I always dreamed of coming to America. And when I was 24 years old, I came to America. Oh, by the way, I came here legally, okay? So don't get any funny ideas. If you don't like my pitch, you cannot call immigration, okay? And I remember I landed in Miami. I was 24 years old, and this is 1961. And I tell you, in 1961, coming to America was like going to Mars. Because in Argentina, there was no TV yet. Now, with CNN and, you know, the World Village, right? We all know what's going on all around the world. But in 1961, it was like going to an adventure, going to America. It took me 24 hours because in those days, the airplanes were propellers. 24 hours, and I landed in Miami. And I remember we had a two-hour layover in Miami, and I got out of the airport, and I saw all these new American cars in the parking lot. And in 1961, to have an American car, you had to be a millionaire. So I walked around touching them, truly touching them. I said, wow, in this country, everybody's a millionaire. I'm in the right place. And from there, I went to the easiest place from a hick boy from Argentina like me to live, New York. And I remember I had never seen snow. And the second day in New York, snow 14 inches. It was about this tall. And I walked in it. I rolled in it. I made a snowman and I threw snowballs. I absolutely adored it for a day. Then it melted, you know. And it was very difficult at the beginning because, you see, when you come here legally, you have to show that you speak English, that you have some money, you have a profession. And I learned English, but in New York, nobody speaks English. They speak Brooklynese. So I couldn't understand anybody, you know, and I had to go to school to learn English. And this is my opinion, so I hope I don't offend anybody, but I feel if I come here, I should speak English. You know, I'm sorry, you know. And and by the way, if you go to Argentina, you better learn Spanish. We have no bilingual education in Argentina, okay? So, and I was going to school to learn English, and it was so difficult to communicate. It was like being deaf and mute. And I didn't know I had an accent. If you think I have an accent now, you should have heard me 35 years ago. You know, I remember I was in here in this country like for 6 months, and I went to see this movie with this young lady, and it was a movie with Gina Lollobrigida and Rock Hudson. And all of a sudden, I realized Gina had an accent. And I said to my date, boy, she has thick accent. And she says, oh, no, no, it's very charming, just like yours. I have accent? And she says, oh, yes, and it's so charming. And I went home, And the next day, I bought a tape recorder. And caca, 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 did I have an accent? I sounded like Frito Bandido. Oh, God. Now I sounded like my parents in Argentina, you know, and I was so ashamed of them. I wouldn't be caught dead with my parents in the street. They spoke funny, you know. And I wanted to belong in America. You know, I always, you know, when I came here, I always wanted to be a wasp, you know. I just wanted, you know, and I used to buy my clothes in Brooks Brothers, you know, my three-piece suit with button-down shirts, you know. But in those days, I had a huge mustache and a huge black afro, and I looked like a Mexican yuppie, you know. I never belonged, you know. And I never liked anything about myself. That's basically why I drank. I remember once I read, you know, that Leonardo da Vinci, who was a genius, one of the greatest genius who ever lived, he said, the perfectly proportioned man is 7 times the size of his head. Now, he was a genius. So I measure my head. Now, this is extra large, okay? According to that, I am supposed to be 7 feet 2 inches tall. Every time I looked in the mirror, I saw this little midget with his huge head. In those days, I had an afro, so it was even bigger. I didn't like nothing, the way I talked. You see my nose? It looks like a bell pepper, right? I'm glad you think it's funny. I had a nose job. I'm the only person I know who looks the same before and after. I went home and my mother didn't realize I had a nose job. I was so pissed. Mom, made in America, $1,700. She didn't like it, you know. Anyway, and I wanted to, you know, I wanted to belong. I wanted to be an American, you know. So I wanted to socialize. So he told me, in order to socialize, you had to go to a bar. Now, I was an athlete in Argentina, and I never drank it. You know, people say they had the first drink and they knew they were alcoholics. I didn't. From age 12 until 18, or 10 until 18, I was at home. You know, they always served me a little bit of wine, about this much wine, and the rest of club soda. I would leave half the glass. So for me, I had to cross the invisible line. But I wanted to belong. I wanted to meet you. You see, and they told me in America to socialize, you had to go to a bar. In Argentina, we invite you to eat. You see, OA is very big in Argentina. You know what I mean? And so I said, oh, I want to go to a bar and meet the Americans, you know. So I dressed in my three-piece suit, you know, my Brooks Brothers suit. And since I didn't speak very good English, I said, I want to learn how to say, you know, I learned how to say, whiskey, whiskey, you know, just like in the movie, whiskey, okay. So I walked into this bar, right, I never been to a bar. And I looked around, it was mostly men. About 2 or 3 ladies, you know. And most of the men who looked, they were tall, blonde, with crew cuts, dark suits, and dark ties. And I thought they were a bunch of Mormons. You see, because you see, the only Americans I knew in Argentina were the Mormons missionaries. And they all dressed the same. Dark suits, dark tie, crew cuts, you know. They used to come to a little town in Argentina to try to change us. From unhappy little Catholics to unhappy little Mormons. You see? Oh, they were very nice people, and they played great basketball. The only problem with them is they cannot play on Sundays. You see? I didn't know the Mormons didn't drink, so I thought this was a Mormon bar. They all looked like Mormons to me. So the bartender came over, right? And I didn't know English too well, and he goes like, you see, English to us like Spanish to you. When you don't know the language, it's gibberish. But I was prepared. I said, whiskey. And he kept going like, and I kept saying, whiskey. You know, now in hindsight, I realized he was asking me, what kind of whiskey? On the rocks with soda? I don't know. I kept saying, whiskey, whiskey. He got pissed. So he grabbed this little glass, a shot glass. But I never seen a shot glass in my entire life. I never been to a bar. So he puts his little glass in front of me. He grabbed this funny looking bottle with a beak. And he goes, glug, 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 glug. And he fills the glass, the little glass, and he puts it in front of me. And I look at this little glass.
And I looked around, all the Mormons had tall glasses. Why does it give me such a little glass? Is it because I'm short? Or maybe he's trying to punish me because I'm not a Mormon. I don't know. But I wanted to act macho, right? So I picked up the little glass and I swallowed the whole thing. Oh, God! It came out of my ears, my eyes. I almost died. But this guy who was standing next to me, a Mormon that was standing next to me, spoke a little Spanish. He said, why don't you drink Cuba Libre? Ah, Cuba Libre. Easy to pronounce. Cuba Libre, por favor. Cuba Libre, por favor. And they gave me Cuba Libre. It was rum and coke. It was sweet. And I'm addicted to sugar. I loved it. And from then on, I drank everything with coke. Scotch and coke. Vodka and coke. And finally, I graduated to sangria and coke. That was my drink of choice. Yeah! Sangria and coke, baby. Bring it down. Feeling good. Woo! And, you know, I kept drinking more and more. I really progressed very fast, you know. I was such a pathetic drunk. I began because I was always an isolator. You know, I was always a lonely person. And loneliness, they call in psychiatry the fear of love. If you really get to know me, you're not going to like me. So I'm not going to let you get close to me. And the book says loneliness affects almost every alcoholic. And the worst loneliness is not when you live alone. It's when you live with other people, with a family, and you cannot communicate even with them. And I didn't understand it because, you know, in a year and a half, you know, I was in America. I already had my apartment. I had the right clothes. I have the furniture from Bloomingdale's. I had some hand-cut glass, you know, baccarat glass. And I had the ties and the suits. I had gone to Europe and visited 9 countries. I had achieved the American dream. I have this apartment looking to Manhattan. How come I still feel like a piece of garbage? And you told me why when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. You told me I was looking for a material solution to a spiritual problem. And you told me nothing that I can see with my eyes can fix my insides. You told me the purpose of this program is established in page 45. This is lack of power that was a dilemma. That's the main purpose of this book is to help you find a power greater than yourself that will solve your problem. It's not an apartment. It's not a girlfriend or boyfriend. It's not clothes. It's not a job. It's a power greater than yourself that will solve the problem. I didn't know. I wanted those things that I had seen in American magazines in Argentina. And I had them. And I was a very miserable young man. And I began drinking more and more. And I had my first suicide attempt because I was always depressed. I had a PhD in depression. You know what I mean? You don't say good morning to me, I'll kill myself. And I remember taking the first 40 pills, you know. And I remember the feeling, you know, it was like a horizontal line coming down. Oh, this is so cool, so peaceful. I don't have to be tall. I don't have to be good looking. I don't have to conquer New York. I don't have to speak perfect English. This is so peaceful. I was dying. Total surrender. And I didn't know it. But chicken shit that I am, I pick up the phone and I called my friend Rudy. And Rudy's wife had done the same thing. You know, he said, Hector, if you don't call me from the hospital in 10 minutes, I call the cops. Well, my God, I want to be dead, but I don't want the cops in my house. How embarrassing. So I floated to Bellevue, which is 5 blocks away. And they pumped my stomach, and they made me see shrinks. And I began seeing shrinks, and I saw lots of shrinks for a long time. And I began with more suicide attempts, and I always was depressed. And, you know, I know what's going to fix it. I know what's going to fix it. If I become an actor, if I can, you know, become an actor and everybody loves me, I'm going to be okay. And I became, and I was going to be the greatest actor who ever lived. I was going to do Richard III better than Olivier in London. Now, that's kind of difficult when you can't speak English. And I became an actor, you know, and I said, well, if I see myself on TV in a commercial, I'm going to be okay. And I saw myself in a commercial, and I was not okay. And I saw myself in two commercials, and I was not okay. Ah, any idiot does commercials, actor. Even Joe Nimitz does commercials. No. You had to do theater, you know. You had to do the real thing. And I got into this play, and this play with Joseph Papp, did off Broadway. We went to Broadway and we won all the awards on Broadway. We won the Tony, which is equivalent to the Oscar in movies. I remember the first preview that I walked on stage on Broadway. I couldn't remember my lines because, oh my God, from Argentina to Broadway. Oh my God, from Argentina. I was thinking, I blew the scene because I couldn't believe that this piece of garbage was on Broadway. And you know, I continued drinking more and more. I had two more suicide attempts and I got more depressed. I was so lonely. Sometimes they used to come to my apartment and say, oh, my apartment's on fire. At least the firemen will be there and we'll have something to talk about. And finally, you know, after all this depression, all this drinking, I had a moment of clarity. We all do. And I realized what my problem was. New York. This is a very isolated, hostile town. All these horrible people. I have to move to a more nurturing, caring, loving place. So I moved to Hollywood. And you know, I was always an isolator. But I mean, when you are in New York, you go down the elevator, you open the doors, you go outside, it's 10,000 people. They are all ready to mug you, but they're there. In L.A., everything is 2 miles away. You need a car to go to the bathroom. You know what I mean? I became more isolated. And, you know, and I got successful. I did this TV show and a guest star in this other TV show and a guest star in this. And still I felt like a piece of garbage. And all of a sudden I realized what was going to fix it. If I get a Mercedes. You know, I used to get drunk with sangria and coke and go to the Mercedes showroom in Hollywood and start crying, asking God for the Mercedes. Oh, please, God, give me Mercedes. If I have another yellow Mercedes, I'm going to be so happy. Please, that one, God. And God got pissed off. And he says, I'm going to show you, little asshole. And he stole my Mustang. And I went out and bought a Mercedes. And I couldn't believe this piece of garbage had a Mercedes, you know. And I used to go to the supermarket. It was 2 blocks away. I have no friends to visit, okay? So I come home. Instead of going home, I had to drive the Mercedes. I drive around the block, you know, singing. I have a Mercedes, cookie, cookie. Smells like leather, cookie, cookie. I have a Mercedes. And I didn't think when I came here, my life was unmanageable. You know, and I remember at night I used to go down the elevator, you know, and the garage, and baby talk to my Mercedes in Spanish. Ay, qué lindo el Mercedito, qué bonito que está. Pues mira, qué lindo el amarillito. God, I was so sick. And it didn't fix it, you know, and I kept drinking more and more, you know, and I was never into pills, you know, only when I would try to kill myself. I get some pills and try to kill myself. But I remember somebody once gave me, what's it called, a blue beauty or something. He says, Hector, this will give you a lot of energy. And I took one of those, and I cleaned my apartment 3 times in 1 day. I said, never again. I'm clean, but not that clean. You know, I'm a Latino actor. I'm always playing bad guys, you know. I'm always molesting somebody. I'm killing somebody. I sold children. I sold dope. I've been handcuffed on TV more time than the Menendez brothers. You know what I mean? I'm always playing bad guys, you know. And finally, I got this part, you know, in a movie of the week for TV called Wanted, the Sundance Woman. And I was going to play a good guy. It was a sequel to Butch Cassidy and Sundance Kid with Catherine Ross. and I'm going to got a good part of a good guy. I'm going to play Pancho Villa's right-hand man, a heavy-duty Mexican bandido with a, you know, with a mustache and the bullets across the chest and the hat and the guns, and I am going to save the girl. Oh, I was so happy. I'm not going to have sex with the girl. You know what I mean? I was going to save the girl. Hey, it's progress, not perfection. At least, you know, they don't kill me. So they gave me the part, and I go home, you know, and they forgot to ask me something. So the director calls me at home and says, Hector, can you ride a horse? Can I ride a horse? I'm a gaucho from Argentina. I was born on a horse, senor, you know. I lied. So we go to Tucson, and we do all the exteriors. Now we're going to do the interiors, right? No, we do all the interiors. We do all the interiors. Now we're going to do the exteriors. We're going to ride around the jail and save Catherine Ross. So we are going to rehearse now. So they put me on top of that stupid animal, the horse. And, you know, if you ride properly, this is a horse. This is you. Nice. When I did it, it was like... Oh, the director didn't think it was funny. He got very upset. He cursed. Hector, you lied to us. We told you, you know, this man and the horse are like a unit. Why did you lie to us? Well, make your practice. They put me on top of that stupid animal for 4 hours. I couldn't get off. When I got off, I could not get my legs together. And my ass was a huge blister. I couldn't sit. So I got half a gallon of sangria, some Coca-Cola. I went to my room in the motel and I did what we all do. I soothed my pain. And then the next day we get on the set. I said to the director, I cannot sit on that horse. My ass is a huge blister, sir. We don't give a damn. Even if you die, you're going to do it. And you know what they did? They got some wet towels from the hotel and they put it on top of that thing. What is that thing called? The saddle. They put wet... And it was so embarrassing. I'm playing this heavy-duty macho bandido, you know, with wet towels underneath my ass. And everybody's watching me. So now they line us up, you know, and we're going to go and save the girl. And the way they do it, it was six principals, the six of us, you know, and the extras were in the back, and also on horses. And what they do is they have the wranglers, yeah, the Marlboro guys, the wranglers, holding the horse. The sixth principle, well, they say action, they slap the horses in the ass, and they take off like crazy, right? So the wrangler's right there, and they give me the gun. Hector, don't cock the gun until you're galloping, and only shoot in the air. Those blanks are very dangerous. Remember the guy who killed himself with a blank? The actor? John Huxon or something? Okay, so if I get you this close, I'll blow your eyes out, right? But I'll have a hungover. So I said, I'm going to get a shot, just one shot. So I cock the gun, I'm like this, and the horse goes, boom. I shot the wrangler in the ass. Oh, he didn't think it was funny. So we're going to do a retake, right? So the wrangler's holding the horse now like this. But I'm an alcoholic, but I'm not stupid, okay? I cock the gun again. But I put it next to my leg. And it goes, boom. Oh, my God, I shot my leg. My costume is in flames. I don't care. I want to save the girl. I'm an alcoholic. So we save the girl. When I finish the take, my whole costume is in flames. They throw me on the floor. Some blankets, they put out the fire, you know. And they rush me to the hospital. I have a hole about this big in my leg. And they rush me to the hospital. And then they rushed me to L.A. And I was in the hospital for a whole month. I have two operations. One to remove the infection because he got infected. And another operation for his skin graft. While I was in the hospital, my agent didn't send me flowers. I'm very sensitive. If you don't send me flowers, I'll kill myself. So I asked my friend Irene to bring me some sleeping pills. And she did, and I took about 40 of them. Well, I wanted to sleep. And that was my last suicide attempt and my best one. I was in coma for 3 days in intensive care unit. While I was in coma, I had two cardiac arrests. My heart stopped twice. and I developed pneumonia. I was basically dead for 3 days. I had everything. I had a brand new Mercedes, the most beautiful wardrobe you've ever seen, a gorgeous apartment, nice clothes, a beautiful view of Los Angeles. I had enough money in the bank to live a whole year without working. The only thing I didn't have, the only thing that was missing, was Hector. I didn't know who I was. One of you defined me when I came to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. This man said I was a huge ball of fear covered with a little human skin. That was me. The book says fear is the overwhelming quality of all alcoholics. It equates fear to a thief because it steals us of our lives. When I woke up in the intensive care unit, I was tied up, my arms, my legs, I had about 15 tubes this way, that way, this way, this way. My crutch was a huge blister because I kept urinating and defecating on myself. I was really dead for 3 days. Anyway, I got out of the hospital real quick in less than a week, and it was too fast. When I went home, I was so weak that I could not get into the elevator because the door would knock me over. That's how weak I was. I was 42 years old. Anyway, my shrink sent me to Alcoholics Anonymous. He said, Hector, you're an alcoholic. Go to Alcoholics Anonymous. What? Are you sure, Mike? Yes, I'm sure. Go. And I went to a meeting. It was seedy and dark. And I said, oh, caca, caca, caca. This is not for me. I'm a winner. You know what I mean? I don't belong here. And then I said, my shrink is going to forget. So 2 weeks later, he says, Hector, do you go to AA? I said, well, Mike, listen, I went to that place. It's despicable. I don't belong there. I said, Hector, there are thousands of meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous in AA. Fine, in Los Angeles. Go to another meeting. And I went to another meeting. It was larger. And it was very bright, and somebody was playing the piano. I said, oh, this looks like a musical comedy. I think I belong here. You know, and I truly, truly love Alcoholics Anonymous. And I'm not a visitor here. I'm a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I do all the things that I suggested, and, you know, in our groups and in the book. You know, I call AA the mafia of love. Newcomers, once you come to a few meetings, you can get out. We are everywhere. Parking lots, the gym, Bullocks, the Broadway, Lucky's. Especially newcomers, when you're coming out of the 7-Eleven at 1 o'clock in the morning with a little brown bag, you'll see one of us and we'll say, hi! We haven't seen your meetings. Anyway, newcomers, stay with us. Nobody wants you anyway. No. Really, newcomers, stay with us and let us love you until you learn how to love yourself. Because that's what this is all about. It's about loving and letting you love me. I'm going to talk now about sobriety, the rest of the pitch, because that's the most important thing. And when I came here, coming from a Catholic background, I had a great deal of, you know, and I got a sponsor, you know. In the first half year and a half, I didn't get a sponsor because I knew that I had to do the fourth and fifth, and I didn't want anybody to get to know me because I'm a piece of garbage. And I got into other things, and sex, and I got into food, you know. And they told me that I was replacing one obsession with another obsession. And they told me, Hector, here, we turn our will in our lives all to the care of God, not to the care of the refrigerator. You know what I mean? Haagen-Dazs is not a good name for a higher power, Hector. And so finally, I got a sponsor, and I did the fourth and fifth, you know. But I had difficulty with God, and I had to find a God that I could understand. And I found a description of God that I want to share with you. But remember, whatever I say from the podium applies only to me, okay? I find this definition of God that really helped me. And it says, by Joel Goldsmith, it says, regardless of how high my concept of God is, it is wrong, because it is still a concept. Eventually, I have to lose all concepts and reach the consciousness that God is. and then leave the subject alone, because with the mind, I've never going to know what God is. And the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous on page 46 says exactly the same thing. It says, even though it was impossible for any of us to fully define or comprehend that power which is God. And on page 53 it says, God is everything or else he is nothing. God either is or he isn't. What was our choice to be? And that works for me. I know that God is. But I cannot understand God. God cannot be described with human words. You know, but I know that God is. How do I know that God is? You proof of it. You not only, because you believe in God and try to act God's will, not only you stop drinking, but you change your lives. This room is full of miracles. I remember this guy who came to our men's stack. He had been in 11 institutions. Really certifiable nuts. You know, and 4 years later in sobriety in Alcoholics Anonymous, he graduated from college magna cum laude. Excuse me, but that's a miracle. Somebody said, you know, a church, a synagogue, or a temple is the house of God. But an AA meeting is God's workshop. Because he loves through us. And I came to believe just for me, that God is incomplete without us. Because he needs us, because he loves through us. He needs our touching, our hugging, our smiling, our kissing, our caring, because he loves through us. That's why God says, if you believe in me, I am. Because that's what I believe God is. It's a spiritual idea. The book says that. It says, page 52, our ideas did not work, but the God idea did. And there's a lady, a British theologian, and she wrote a book, came out two years ago, called The History of God. And this is a great authority, you know. And she says, you know, through the thousands of years, we used to have many thousands of years, humanity, man had like every religion had like 6-7 gods. A god for love, a god for war, a god for famine, you know. Eventually, the three major religions, all the major, ended up with one god. It's called monotheism. And she asks the question, why is human beings always searching, you know, for have a God, a relationship with a higher power? And she says, because we can give a meaning to our lives, give them more value. And she also says in the book, that probably God is man's most interesting idea, you know. And once I got my concept of God, and this I got the knowledge I got, you know, about 2 years ago, about working the steps. And I work the steps, and I stay sober, and I do commitments, and I pray, and I meditate. But about 2 years ago, I realized about the steps, you know, we all say the steps are going to keep us sober. Yes, the end result of working the steps is sobriety. But just for me, the 12 steps of alcoholics have not to achieve sobriety. The 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous are spiritual tools to develop a conscious contact with God. If you notice in the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, the word sobriety is not mentioned. Recovery is not mentioned. Not even the word alcoholism is mentioned. But there is one word that is mentioned 9 times in the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. Check it out. That word is God. God. And so I came to believe, you know, just for me, the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, and then, you know, are spiritual tools to develop a conscious contact with God. On page 32 of the 12 of 12, it says, the fact was we really had not cleaned house so that the grace of God could enter us and expel the obsession. Therefore, we remained self-deceived and so incapable of receiving enough grace to restore us to sanity. So that's what I have to do. Receive enough grace to restore me to sanity. And what is God's grace? The book doesn't define God's grace. And the easiest way to say it, I was taught here, is God's grace is an unmerited gift. I haven't done anything to receive that gift from God. And God's grace is available to everybody. God's grace, you know, is like the sun. When the sun comes out, it doesn't shine just on the sober people of Alcoholics Anonymous or people who go to church or synagogues. The sun shines on everybody.
It's available to everybody. But if I locked inside my house and I pulled down the curtains, I really shut myself from the sunshine of the Spirit. That's what the book says. You know, there's always this example, this parable that's given, you know. Everybody's a lamp. But unless a lamp is plugged to the electricity, it cannot shine. So if I want that God's grace working in my life, I have to make myself a recipient of that grace. How do I do that? Very simply, by working the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. And you know, there are workshops and beautiful tapes about the 12 steps, but I'm going to go through them in 5 minutes. The first step says I have a problem. The second step says I need a solution. The third step says the solution is God. I have to turn my will and my life over to the care of God. In very simple terms, my will is my thoughts. My life is my action. My life is the sum total of my action. A man is not judged by what he drives, how he dresses, or how much money he has in the bank. A man is judged by his action. Somebody once said in Alcoholics Anonymous, your action is so loud, I cannot hear what you're saying. So now I'm at step three, and I had to turn my will and my life over to the care of God. How do I do that? Very simply, by working the rest of the steps. Now I had to do an inventory, because the book says I'm blocked from the sunshine of the Spirit. I have these blockages. Where are these blockages? These blockages are my character defects. And I had to list them and then go and share with God and another human being. Because I practice all this garbage on a daily basis, and they're keeping me from the sunshine of the Spirit. And this fourth and fifth is a relationship with myself. And it has two purposes. One is very humbling. And I had priests. I had confession. I have 5 shrinks before I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. And they're wonderful people. But the reason why Alcoholics Anonymous works for me is because it's designed by alcoholics for alcoholics. It's custom made for me. So I used to tell my shrink this and that, but it's quite different when you sit in front of another person and you tell them your entire life. Is very humbling. And also what happens is, if your sponsor does it right, you realize, you know, you're not such a flake. You know, that's such a freak. He's done the same thing. I was so afraid that you would not like me. And when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, I met all the other Hectors. Some were black, some white, some Gentiles and Jews, some male, some female, some were gay, some straight, some old, some young, some fat, some skinny. All the other Hectors. This is a spiritual program. It's a communion with the Spirit. And the wonderful thing about the Spirit, all the spirits are equal. We don't care where you come from, what you've done, what you look like. We love you. So I'm now at step five. Now I have to go home and for an hour look on my list of the things I've done and then do ask God. 6, getting ready, and 7, ask God to remove these defects. And the book says that most of them will be removed. With some of them, I'll have to be content with improvement. That's why Bill Wilson later on designed step number 10. So now I ask God to remove them. Am I ready to receive God's grace? Well, not really. I have all this garbage I've done when I was drinking. I fornicated so-and-so, I ran from you, I kicked your dog, I did so and such to do, and over there, I cannot walk over there. I walk like this. So I had to do 8 and 9. 8 and 9 is my relationship with the universe, with all of you. Now the channel is clean. Can I receive God's will or God's grace? Yes, I can. There's a problem. I'm an alcoholic. As an alcoholic, I'm going to screw up on a daily basis. So Bill Wilson gave us step number 10, which is a daily tool to really keep the channel clean. When we were wrong, we promptly admitted it. So to be ready to have that, you know, that relationship with God. Now we come to step 11, prayer and meditation. And that's what I had to do to improve my contact with God. Prayer and meditation. And I know some people poo-poo, you know, sometimes, you know, prayer and meditation. They're phenomenal tools. They've been around for thousands of years before Alcoholics Anonymous was a glint in God's eyes. And what is prayer? Prayer is a dialogue with God.
Man has always longed for a relationship with God, and prayer is the proper vehicle to talk to God. And most of us don't like prayer, and we get tired of prayer. We have to do it over and over again. And it takes great faith to keep on praying when we don't see material results. You know? And the thing about prayer is even when I don't feel like doing, I have to do it. Because if I want to develop a relationship with you or with you, I want you to be my friend, I'm going to go and have coffee with you, talk to you on the phone. I have to spend some time with you. So how come I cannot spend 5 minutes a day with my higher power, which is the source of my fulfillment, which is the greatest power who ever lived, the greatest talent, the most incredible thing? How come I cannot spend 5 minutes and I can spend 2 hours watching stupid negative TV? And I cannot spend 5 minutes with God on my knees. And the proper way to... I pray during the day. Sometimes I thank God. But you told me the proper way to pray is on my knees. Just to show... And no, being on my knees is not a position of comfort. It's a position of reverence and respect for my higher power. And I had to set every day a time to talk to my higher power, he told me. Because that's the source of all my happiness and all my well-being. And what do I do after I pray? I shut up. That's meditation. I shut out the material world. And I had to do a sitting down in a comfortable position so I forget about my body. Meditation is not a mental experience or a body experience. It's a spiritual experience. I had to go to a higher plateau. Remember, the book says the disease is a spiritual, physical, and mental. We should take care of the spiritual malady, and the other two will follow. And I have to just sit quietly and go deep within myself, where the kingdom of God is. And no, I cannot skip meditation. I have to do it. Somebody says silence is the highest form of prayer. And if I want to achieve any wisdom... You see, the first step to wisdom is silence. The second step is listening. That's why God gives us one mouth, but 2 ears. I have to listen. When I'm talking to you, I'm learning nothing. Because I'm talking about something I already know. But tomorrow, or this afternoon, when I heard that beautiful pitch by Camille, I learned something. Because that's why I still come to Alcoholics Anonymous. Because God speaks to me through you. You know, okay, so now I developed a modicum of spiritual enlightenment. I am a little bit spiritual. And trust me, I'm not a spiritual guru. I mean, I sound like Mother Teresa from the podium. They put me in traffic and I become Charles Manson. I don't walk like I talk. I still goof off. I still make mistakes. But I'm a good person. I have a good program. I'm not perfect. Please. I'm not perfect. So now that I achieved this spiritual enlightenment, a little bit of a spiritual enlightenment, what is the purpose of that? Only one, and only one, to help you. I can be the most enlightened person, walk on water, unless I'm helping to another alcoholic, my program is worth nothing. The book of Alcoholics Anonymous says, faith without works is dead. And it says it twice. You know, why do I have to help you? You told me, in order to keep it, I have to give it away. You know, spiritual affluence, the word affluence comes from the French, affluer, means to flow. I have to keep, you know, this spiritual power going. And you told me, the only thing that I can keep is what I give away. I mean, the only thing that I will own is what I can give away. Khalil Gibran, a great poet, once said, when we die, the only thing we take with ourselves is what we have given away. And the most precious thing we can give away is a gift to oneself. That's step 12. Anyway, I did my amends and I cleaned up my house, you know, but the most difficult thing for me to do And I did all my steps. I have a sponsor. I sponsor people. I have 2 commencements a day. I go and answer the phones. I'm really connected to Alcoholics Anonymous. Not because I'm good. Not because I'm spiritual. Because I'm a flake. And if I stop going to meetings and being in contact with you, I'll drink. I have to come here to be reminded of the things I already know. And so I did all the things that I was supposed to do, but you know, I hated my parents. I disliked them so much. I disliked them so much. And you told me that not liking my parents was like being an apple, but not liking apple trees. If I don't like my source, how am I going to feel good about myself? And I discovered something about parents. It's like we have double standards in Alcoholics Anonymous. If a newcomer walks through that door and he says, I just came out of jail. I was in jail because I killed 5 people, robbed 15 banks, and I just kicked my dog. Oh, welcome! You're one of us. Do you want some cookies and coffee? And later on, we'll take you out to dinner. Instant forgiveness. Not with our parents. They had to be perfect. Are we perfect? I don't know about you. But I don't know. You know, when I went to do my 8th and 9th, I didn't want justice. I wanted forgiveness. And if I was to get the justice for all the garbage I did when I was drinking, you don't want to be standing next to me when I get it. And the book says that resentment is the number one offender. It is fatal. It kills more alcoholics than anything else. And it doesn't exclude parents. And I had to do inventories. And yes, my mom chained me and beat me up. But that was 25% of the equation. You know, I had to look at the whole thing. She was an Italian peasant who married when she was 15. She never went to school. And that was wrong. And 25% was wrong. And I do not condone child abuse. But I do that. I did a lot of garbage that I want to talk about from the podium when I was drinking. And I want you to forgive me. And I want you to love me. And I look at the other 75%. There's no welfare in Argentina. My mom worked every single day from 6 o'clock in the morning until 11 o'clock at night at 2 jobs. My father beat her up. She beat us up once in a while. But you know, I remember when I was 6 years old, we didn't have money for a Christmas tree. My mom grabbed a broomstick, some wire, some crepe paper, and she made a Christmas tree. 4 branches, 5 branches, 6 branches, about this tall. She went out with a quarter, and she bought a Christmas point and 4 Christmas balls. But guess what? I have my Christmas tree. And when I was 12 years old, working at 2 jobs, she gave me a bright new bicycle imported from Italy. That was 50 years ago. It was almost like buying a kid a convertible now. She was doing the best she could with the tools she had. We don't have no heat, so at night she would heat this brick and wrap it in old rag, and she would warm up the bed and put the brick on my feet so I would stay warm. Sure, she did the best she could with the tools she had. Yeah, she made mistakes, so did I, and I want you to forgive me. When I had 2 years sobriety, I sent my mom a ticket. She had never been on a plane, and she came to Los Angeles. And in my apartment, she had a 10-feet-tall Christmas tree, 12-feet-tall, 12-feet-tall Christmas tree, real pine, decorated in her favorite colors, pink and red. And she had 32 presents underneath the Christmas tree. It took me a whole week to wrap them. You know, and I told my mom how much I loved her. And I thanked my mom for all the sacrifices she made. And my mom is a good man, mom. She's the best she could with the tools she had, and I'm a good son. And I brought her another time with my sister. And I remember once while they were talking in the living room, talking to my sister, my mom said, you know, to my sister, Olga, you know what I wish for all the mothers in the world? And Olga said, what? That they could have a son like my Hector. That's as good as it gets. My mom died a month and a half ago, and I'm okay. I'm okay. Because that relationship is healed. I love my mom, and she's in heaven. She was 90 years old. The relationship with my father was a little more difficult. Finally, he left my mom. He moved to Syria, married, and he had a different family altogether. I hadn't heard from him in 12 years. And he sent a letter from Syria saying, you know, oh, son, how are you? I haven't heard from you in such a long time. How are you doing? Oh, by the way, I need some money to pay some taxes. Can you send me some money? Oh, and my family here says if nobody talks to me from the other side of the ocean, I must have done something wrong. If I did, I apologize. You bastard, did you do something wrong? And I began writing back, listing everything he did wrong. And now I'm sober in Alcoholics Anonymous and I don't lie. And it was a long list. Long list. And then I made a mistake. I asked an old timer what to do. And she says to me, Hector, Hector, if your father took 10 years or 12 years to write to you, why do you have to answer right away? And Hector, would you rather be right or would you rather be at peace? I want to be right. I waited my entire life for this moment. But chicken shit that I am, I sent the letter, but it was not enough. I forgave him. I sent a loving letter. About 5 years ago, I went to see the shrink who sent me to AA, and I went for a few sessions. I don't go to him for sobriety. I love the man. He likes so much what happened to me. He sent 6 other people to AA. And I don't know. I was feeling uncomfortable. And after 2 sessions, he says, I know what the problem is, Hector. You had to go and spend some time with your father in Syria. Syria? Syria's full of Syrians. They all look like my father, Mike. I thought it was the stupidest thing in the world, and twice as stupid coming from a man who's so intelligent as him. You know, but I'm a people pleaser. So I called my father in Syria, you know, and he sounded senile on the phone, so somebody else talked on the phone, and I landed in Syria at the Damascus airport. And this giant who used to beat me up, he was about this tall. Little man, old man, with just a few, you know, white hairs on the side and his funny baggy pants. And he comes over and runs over and he hugs me and he kisses me and he's sobbing and he's touching my face and he's sobbing and grabbing me and I'm sobbing with him and his entire family is crying. I'm crying with these people I don't know. With this man I don't really know. This is my dad. I don't know my dad. I never talked to my dad. My dad never said, Hector, how you doing in school? He never did that. So then he grabs me by a hand like a 5-year-old and he takes me to his hotel in Damascus, you know. And in the hotel he told me he couldn't sleep for 3 days because he was so excited that I was coming. And my brother-in-law says, no, he was not senile when you called him on the phone. He was sobbing so much, he couldn't talk on the phone. So we had to grab the phone away from him. And then he took me to this little village where he lives. And this is a very poor village. Syria is a very frightening place because everything is like an army, you know what I mean? Everybody's in green uniforms. Even the kids go to elementary school in green uniforms. There are cannons all over the place. I've been in 20 countries, but I've never been afraid. I even was in East Germany when it was communist. I was not afraid, but I was afraid in Syria. And he took me to this little village and he told me his story. He never had a father. His father died when he was 6 months old. His mom was 15 years old. She never went to school. My daddy never went to school. How is this man going to know how to be loving, caring, nurturing father? He had no idea. He was to Argentina, was 16 or 17, then he married my crazy mother. He had no cue. But I realized he loved me. He always loved me. I just did not love him. I wanted somebody like Nelson Rockefeller, property, money, and prestige. But this little peasant, this man, is my daddy. He made me dress in a suit in this very poor village. He sat me in the living room, put some food in front of me, steak, because steak is very expensive, and he made me eat it. While I was eating, he invited all the villagers from the village to come and look at my son from America. That's my son from America. And they would come and shake my hand and talk Arabic. I don't know what they were saying. But that's how proud he was of me. Even a blind person without shoes walked into the house. And they guided his hand to touch my face. It was an incredible scene. It was just expression of his love. And I stayed there for 8 days. And I photographed my daddy. And I have some videos of my daddy. When I left Syria at the Damascus airport, we both really sobbed. And we embraced and sobbed. And we embraced and sobbed. And I said, Daddy, I'm very, very proud that you are my daddy. And he just looked at me and said, Son, I'm 10 times more proud that you're my son. And this trip here is the most beautiful gift anybody could have given me. No money in the world could buy something more beautiful than this. Now I can die in peace. And we hugged and hugged and sobbed and sobbed. And I left. And when I came to America, something had changed. You see, I always looked like a man, I sounded like a man, I accomplished like a man, I dressed like a man, but inside I was a 12-year-old child. Because you see, being like a man was being like my father, and I hated my father. I don't want to be a man, because that's a man. And now I know what a real man is, or a real woman. Is somebody who is at peace with himself. Has nothing to do with what I own, what I drive, you know, what my house looks like. And I have a beautiful home. I live an upper middle class life. And that's good. Having money is good. I just have to understand that that gives me physical comfort. Inner peace comes from a relationship with a higher power through the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. It comes from helping you, for loving you. It's wonderful that you love me, but it's infinitely much more important that I love you. The only healing love is the love I give you. That's why the big book says when everything else fails, it doesn't say go out and buy another cashmere sweater. When everything else fails, go and find a newcomer to help and to work with and to care for. I'm selfish and self-centered. And I had to get off that. I had to get God-centered so I'd be good enough to help you. You know, once I saw a movie called The Elephant Man. It's a movie about a very ugly, deformed person. Really deformed. Who lives on the streets and eats from the garbage cans and he dresses in rags and he smells real bad. He's like a monster. And the children throw rocks at him and they chase him because he's so ugly. And he's a very pathetic thing. And this doctor and this nurse pick him up and they bring him to the hospital to study him. And they bathe him. They put fresh clothes on him and they treat him with love. And lo and behold, he's very articulate. He's quite smart. And you look at him in the film and the face doesn't change. It's the same person. But you get a chance to see what's inside of him, the child of God. And I look at him and say, I like this guy. I could be his friend. And he's kind of talented. He's almost like an architect. And he begins to do some of this little church. And some ladies come and partake in conversation with him, you know, and they kind of like him. And when I saw this, I said, wow, this is the story of all of us in Alcoholics Anonymous. We come here feeling ugly, inside and out. And this beautiful program, these meetings, you know, the love, the understanding, the care, the nurturing, the guidance that we get in these meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous and this phenomenal program, little by little, the layers built on fear ever so gently come down. And they come down and then come down until the most beautiful person in the world emerges, ourselves. You see, we're all children of God. God made no mistakes. We just have to get in touch with it. That's what he and AA would call it, an inner journey. God is not out there trying to get in. He's in here. The kingdom has got in here. Try to get out. How do we do that? By staying sober, working the steps, with the help of the sponsor, by getting involved in service, by giving, by loving, by touching, by smiling. You know, I came here 16 and a half years ago, a pathetic little frightened man. And I came here just to stop drinking. And you, beautiful, beautiful people of Alcoholics Anonymous, taught me how to live. You're such a great, loving teachers. Please keep coming back. I want more. You're not finished with me. You're not finished with me. I love you. I love you and thank you.